This is the fifth reel of a taped interview with Norden Digby in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 31st of the 10th, 2001, in the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Now, we've been talking, Norden, the last time we spoke about your understanding of the situation on around about the 10th of July, 1942, at your position, the Hill of Jesus, Tel Aviv. Could you tell us then how things developed from that point?
Following the actions in the 10th and 11th of July, the whole of the coastal occupied area was subjected to continuous artillery bombardments, followed up by Stuka dive bombing. Fortunately for us, new reinforcements, we'd heard so much about the Stuka dive bombing at Tobruk and that, so we had a fair idea of what to expect and not to be disturbed in regards to the screamers that they had on the aircraft in their dive approach upon the areas that they were to bomb.
How did the reality differ from what you've been told?
Well, with the attacks in Europe on civilians, there was a considerable amount of, let's say, terror or panic involved as soon as these dive bombing attacks occurred, and which was all to the advantage of the Axis force plans, causing panic and disruption and all those sorts of things. We realised that, we had to determine whether we'd be in the same sort of situation as the civilians, but the point was that we were disciplined people, or reasonably disciplined people, and so we were able to be prepared, knowing a bit more about the methods of their attacks and the screaming of the aircraft and in their dives on the areas. So, and plus the fact that experience had been applied in Tobruk, and we, as I previously mentioned, as reinforcements had a fair idea of what the effects were, so we weren't put in that situation that the civilians were in the previous attacks in Europe, and probably may have been in with some of the other allied troops in the French and other areas.
How often did the Stukas come over?
Well, there was definitely no fixed times. They just come out of the blue any time during the daytime, you couldn't put any fixed time. The first thing you'd hear the planes. Of course, you've got to remember that Rommel had the upper hand. He had the supremacy in the air. The Allies virtually had nothing to counter them, or what they did didn't take long to be shot out of the air with more modern Messerschmitts against the older designs of the British RAF and RAAF planes.
How many planes would be involved in a raid usually?
Let's see, in the Germans, I say, or Rommel's Air Force, I suppose, or half a dozen at a time, it might occur 3 to 5 times a day, spread over the day. And then, of course, the other favourite trick was with the Messerschmitts, they'd come in from a raid or an action, and they'd fly about 50 feet above the ground and try and strafe anybody that was on the ground, or it might be for a bit of amusement for the fellows that were involved in early morning ablutions. And there's many a person that got caught with his trousers down and was virtually hobbled and trying to escape. But,
what was the feeling then of being in this situation where you're virtually helpless to attack from the air?
Well, there's not much you can do about it. So you and you basically what fast flying low level planes is pretty difficult. The only retaliation that we would have would be the use of small arms, for the hoping that a stray bullet might get in some essential part of the aircraft, which did happen from time to time. I know in my own particular situation, I fired a Thompson submachine gun at them. That I mean, they only had a trajectory of about a couple of hundred yards. But anything like that, too. Well, at least fight back, even if it was like the Palestinians throwing bricks at the Israelis. So that was the situation. And of course, the other thing was that. The artillery were firing and exploding above ground level, and that was a bit horrific because of the shrapnel. And that
didn't be 88 millimeters.
No, that would have been 75s or something of that nature. I'm just trying to think of the name that we're. They used to burst from black smoke and hunks of iron go or over the place. But I just can't remember what the World War One fellows used to name that air burst. But another rather humorous situation was that, well, it probably wasn't at the time. Our drivers and that were away from us behind a range with their trucks and other transport, and they were being shelled and these air bursts, they had a foul smell about them, and particularly with our troop, with our they were supposed to carry respirators with us. They were conveniently put on the back of a truck, and the truck never made the area. And of course, someone reckoned it was gas. And no respirators, what are we going to do? So apparently, somebody must have heard of the stories about the World War One fellows urinating in their socks or clothes and things like that, that apparently they might have thought about it. Anyway, that calmed down, but it was a period which wasn't very pleasant for those concerned, because if it had been gas, they'd have been gone. So those were some of the incidents that happened. And
this has been, as you mentioned earlier on, your first experience of combat. Mm-hmm. How are you coping then with all this going on? First, initially the attacks of the tank, and then the Stukas and artillery fire.
Yeah. Well, I didn't smoke, and I didn't want to smoke, but I thought, well, you know, if I can, I don't know how I'm going to go in this, when we really get into action. And when we first moved down into the flats of Tuilaliza, I didn't have any worries about whether I wanted to smoke or not, and I had so much to do that I just sort of had to, well, experience what was coming up next. So I think without, you know, really being biased about it, but it didn't seem to worry me initially. I wasn't actually scared, sort of business, but the point being that I was still new to this type of lifestyle. But generally speaking, I sort of was able to cope with it. Plus the fact that anything up to 10 or 12 fellas had to look after their situations, and because I was a lift section sergeant that was in charge of two guns, plus the tractors and port eyes and that. So that was in the initial stages. So once I'd got over the barrier of proving whether I was frightened or scared, or I couldn't put up with fighting or anything of that nature, I just sort of settled in with what was happening from day to day. So
what then was the average day like at this particular position for you?
Well, to start with, I'd lost a number one gun commander. I lost him in the, when I say lost, he was taken out at Amarillo and put into left out of battle, LOV as it was called. So I had to look after the two guns, plus the fact I had to be the number one on that particular fellow's gun. So I was pretty well occupied, and I've been there. We all had to do our own gun crew cooking, and then we had to always mounting our night guards and things of that nature, looking after the guns and the ammunition, but particularly, not that we'd fired at that rabbit later, that if we did get used a fair bit of ammunition, then you'd be having to check on your sights that they hadn't jumped and got out of alignment, sort of business. All those, trying to keep your gun camouflaged when you couldn't dig it in because of the amount of rock that was in that particular area. So in theory, the guns were basically sitting on top of the ground, and use whatever you could to build up around it. But I was pretty fortunate there, had an excellent position behind a little hillock, so though our field of fire was reduced, at least we had a reasonable amount of protection from an area. But then there was communication with where the infantry were close by to us, and there was a fair bit of communication with the infantry and things of that nature. Then, of course, when they used to go out on patrols at night time, they were a bit light on for firepower, so we used to lend them a submachine gun or something of that nature. But there's always communication, and it was a bit of fun to throw in amongst that as well. And then when the rations came and things like that, that all had to be sort of sorted out. Not so much, but they were broken up by the quartermaster of the battery into gun groups, and to see that everybody got a fair deal. I don't mean one getting more than the others, but the time they would get certain rations, but wouldn't cover the whole of the battery, so they'd split it up so that each or half the guns got a decent ration of whatever it may be. If it was we did it on occasion get I understand it was New Zealand steak or something of that nature, but it couldn't be split up for the whole battery, so the quartermasters have to work it all out that you'd get it one day and you wouldn't get it the next day or whatever goodies came along. But it was generally, it was just a normal army ration. And I think when the American supplies came in, that was we used to at least get tinned potatoes and things of all those nature, which was quite a help to our health systems. But then the food had to be prepared and cooked and things, all was on open fires. Drum of or a 4-gallon drum with the top chopped out of it, and fill it up with sand and then pour petrol into it and light it up like that. That was in the early days. So that was what happened. So while we're talking about food and that, there was a liquor ration came out. We were getting beer. I just forget what the ration, but you could, let's say, it was one bottle a week or something like that of beer. That was for the gunners and that. But the sergeants could have a bottle of Scotch whiskey. And that we used to buy for 7 and 6 pence for a bottle of Scotch whiskey, which poor old England and Scotland and those were damn lucky to see it. But what would happen, we would there were quite a number of sergeant didn't take the quota, so some of the others might get two bottles or something like that. But I'm not trying to indicate that we were boozed or anything of that nature, but it was quite a break to have a beer, and it wasn't icy cold or anything of that nature. But the other thing was that we always had a bottle of whiskey under the driver's seat, so that if ever we got blown up in a mine or something like that again, it was there. But at night time, the gun crew, and we'd mix up a bottle, it'd be half whiskey, half water or something like that. We'd all have, you'd get one drink out of it. So that was, sort of helped us along a bit.
Keeping up the spirit.
Yeah, it sure was. And when the 51st Highland Division came to be blooded in to us, when I say blooded in, I mean they sent NCOs and officers who a few at a time, and they'd live with us. And of course, though it was called the 51st Highland Division, they'd lost most of their 51st Highland in Dunkirk, I think. But there were some Scots fellows, and there were a lot of Brits in amongst them, Londoners. And they just couldn't get over us. Here we were, coughing their favourite drink and paying 7 and 6 pence for it. But,
what was the situation then, sort of keeping up the morale and sort of keeping your spirits going amongst yourselves? What would you discuss?
Well, I mean, we used to get the general information about what was going on and the rest of the actions around Europe and things of that nature. And I'm not too sure whether one time or other, and I'm talking right through the period, not just the early part of July, that they had a news bulletin that would come out and have some peculiar name or something like that, and then they used to get the radio receptions, and then there'd be the furfies that were created by the fellows that carted water around. They were the ones that they'd make up some sort of a story of what was going to happen next.
And, what were some of those stories that you were
hearing? Not so much at Alamein, but in the other camps and that, when it looked like when we were to come home or move somewhere or other like that. by the time the story got round to everybody, and it had been embroidered every time it was told.
How did that sort of, the fact that you didn't really know what was going on, how did that affect morale and the situation, particularly at the Hill of Dreams televisor?
Yeah.
When you're under such heavy attack?
Well, at the time, the Allies weren't in a very good position, and they weren't having their problems, and there's not much we could do about that. We just have to make the best of what we considered of the situation. Tobruk, the holding out for 6 months in Tobruk was a morale booster, not only for us but for others, because if somebody could hold out, well, there was no reason why we couldn't hold out, as long as we had the supplies and the the leaders. So it was just once again, as I've said, it just went from day to day. And
what was it like then to experience comrade being wounded seriously or even being killed?
Though I didn't have any on out of my section, or one of the neighbouring guns of another troop was in the later action, that one was killed and the rest of were wounded. Because as far, you know, if the gun layer of the tank got onto your position, you could just about forget about anything else, because it didn't have any protection. It had about not a half inch steel shield, which be lucky to keep a bullet out of it. So but then we had fellows that coming up the totalizer, there was a bombing air raid on, and this, of course, the gun crew just fled and jumped off the side of the truck, and then would get the best cover they could find. But this particular fellow, he got underneath the truck and the bomb lobbed on top of him, so that was a finish of him. And there were quite a number of incidents like that.
How would that affect the morale of the troops?
In the early days, it was a bit terrific, particularly for a gun crew, in it to lose somebody. And but I've later on, you know, fellas being brought back, and quite frequently, I went, I think, one or two burial parties, not night time with a padre, and there's a couple of you go to the cemetery and bury the blanks for the business. And I wouldn't say it cold hearted about it, but
did it weaken, do you think, or did it strengthen your resolve to?
No, I don't think. You knew it was going to, there'd be casualties, whether it was by death or by wounding. So you just have to wait for a replacement, and hope you got who is a reasonable sort of a fellow, firstly capable of putting up with the rough stuff and get on with comradeship. So
what then about feelings of your own safety?
Well, I don't know whether I mentioned it to you before, but I had some crackpot idea that, if there's a bombardment on something, and I was going from A to B sort of business, that I wouldn't hit the ground. So on this particular occasion, it was in the daytime, and I walked back towards my gun, and there'd be somewhere around the place, and the next minute I felt this hot piece of iron on my belly, and into my hands, and that really put a stop to that idea of walking around when there's a bombardment of any description.
So shrapnel.
Yeah, if I'd have been a metre forward, it would have penetrated my gut, and Well, if it had been 2 metres, it would probably gone out the other side. So that's the situation.